dressed only in La Perla black panties and a gorgeous Chantal Thomas blush and black corset. Coco padded back into the master bedroom, where Pauline Stryker, naked, was gagged and lashed to a chair, clearly terrified. "What do you think?" Coco asked, running his fingers down the sides of the corset. "Slimming and sensual. Why, Pauline, in my wildest moments, I didn't imagine you and Edwin as the merry widow type. But I suppose what happens behind closed doors just happens and evolves. And then one day I'm here, playing in your kinky side, and you're there." Coco was transfixed by Pauline's fear and didn't move for several moments. Then he grabbed a pair of fine black silk hose, fresh from Paris, and sat in a chair at the vanity. He rolled them on over his toes and up his calves and thighs. Coco loved that sensation. It never got old. "Have you ever had the sense that there were two of you living inside your brain?" Coco asked Pauline, and then he gestured to the corset. "Finding this in your drawer tells me you have. So in case you were wondering, that's what we're doing here. Exploring our personalities. Acting out fantasies, you know?" Pauline Stryker's eyes were glued on Coco. As Coco went by her, he ran the fingernails of his left hand over her cheek softly, saying, "Tonight, there's someone else playing in your head, Pauline. Her name is Miranda. She's a wild child, and I love her." Pauline's brow was knit with confusion when Coco came around the other side of the chair and faced her. "Miranda's a wild child, and I love her," he said again, and felt himself harden. "But she's also my mother, and I hate her." Coco slapped Pauline across the face so hard it left a palm print. Over Pauline's cries and whimpers of pain, Coco said coldly, "Gloves are off, Mummy. No more making things look like suicide for Jeffrey's sake. There's just nothing fulfilling in that anymore."
Chapter 71. "I'm telling you, Sarge, some of the time it sounded like Coco," Johnson said. "She had this distinctive cadence when she talked, and so did that lady."
"Cadence?" Drummond said, skeptical.
"Yeah, like where the word emphasis was," Johnson said. "My wife's a speech pathologist. She knows about this stuff, so I know about this stuff. Did you notice how the voice broke every so often? Old and then kind of younger?" I'd never heard Coco's voice, so I couldn't say, but there had been something odd about the way Johnson's questions had been answered.
"We can't go in on the basis of you saying one woman sounded like another one on a cell phone," Drummond said.
"But maybe I can," I said.
"What?"
the sergeant said, swiveling in his seat to look at me. "You're on the job," I said. "You're handcuffed by the law, but right here, right now, I have no jurisdiction. I am a private citizen with information that suggests a woman might be in danger in that house. Acting on that suspicion, I go into the compound. I look in a few windows. If there's a party going on with Edwin, Pauline, Mize, and others, I slip out. If I see probable cause, I call you."
"You could get shot," Drummond said.
"If I do, you'll be the first to know," I said, getting out of the car.
"How are you getting in?"
asked Johnson.
"The straightforward way," I said, and I shut the door.
It was pouring when I ran across the boulevard, which was lightly traveled at that hour. There was no one in the western lane at all when I accelerated at the gate and then jumped up like I was going for a rebound. Both my hands found the top of the gate and hung on. I kicked and shimmied and pulled until I'd gotten my belly over it. I straddled the gate, pivoted, and then hung down off it and let go. I landed and moved fast into the shadows. The driveway was done in some kind of mosaic tile and was slick and puddled everywhere as I moved past the vegetation that blocked the house from the road. There were lights on in the inner yard, revealing a lawn that looked like a putting green at Augusta. Beds of blooming annuals ringed the house. There were lights on at every corner. Tinier lights lit an arched trellis that framed the main entrance. but unless the strikers were using blackout curtains, there were no lights on in the lower part of the house. I could see at least three rooms on the second story that were lit up, however, and the drumming rain made hearing anything impossible. I wondered whether this had been another impetuous act, the kind of all-in move Bree had been concerned about. But more often than not, I've found it pays to be all in. I ran across the lawn to the walkway and up under the trellis to the door. For a moment, I stood there, trying to hear inside, figuring my scouting trip was likely about to be over. I nevertheless reached for the door handle because, well, you never know. The handle moved down and the locking mechanism gave. The door swung open. You never know. I was torn at that point, because even though the door had been left unlocked, I was still breaking and entering. I hesitated, and then decided to just step inside and listen. If I heard nothing of alarm, I'd be gone. I stepped into a dark, air-conditioned foyer, eased the front door shut behind me, and strained to hear. The distant hum of a refrigerator compressor, the closer ticking of a clock, a drip, drip, that I realized was me leaving puddles on the entryway floor. Then I heard a woman's muffled voice somewhere in the house above me. I couldn't tell what was being said, but I caught the odd rhythm of her speech. Was that what Johnson had been talking about? A smacking noise, a cry, a whimper. I locked in on the sounds, not sure what to do. What if Mize or Coco was torturing her? But what if the strikers and Mize and Coco were into bondage or something, and this was all between consenting adults? The cop in me told me to get the hell out. But when I heard another smack and more crying, the mystery lover in me drove me toward a spiral staircase that rolls off the foyer. I climbed the stairs quietly, moving as fast as I dared. On the landing, I heard the woman's voice again, clearer, but still not intelligible. After kicking off my shoes, I drew the Ruger from my ankle holster and snuck down the hall where I saw a wafer of light coming through a door at the far end. Thankfully, no floorboards creaked or...
What did you expect, Miranda?
A woman said cruelly.
You dress a little boy in silk and lace all the time. This is what you get.
Smack! A moan. A moan of pain or pleasure.
You did teach me a classic sense of style, though. I'll give you that.
The woman went on in that odd, rhythmic voice.
But you denied yourself nothing.
There was a pause before she shouted.
Nothing.
Smack.
Anything you wanted, when you wanted it, mother.
Smack. 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 Each blow sounded louder and more furious than the previous one. If this was some kind of sex act, it was full-on S&M. Whatever it was, home invasion or not, I was going to see who was doing the hitting and who was being hit.
How will it go for you this time, Miranda? Shall we stick with the tried, the true, the erotic? You know what asphyxia does to your orgasm.
That stopped me right outside the door, and I didn't know what to do. If I burst in and it was something consensual, I could kiss a lot of things goodbye. The woman said,
Once it's over, I'll put a toy in you. Complete your method, your scenario.
Then the whimpering turned to whining, amplified by what sounded to me like terror, and I didn't care about anything but stopping it. Gun up, I pushed the door inward, saw an older woman naked, bound to a chair and gagged. There was some kind of wide sash or gold cord biting into her neck. Standing up behind her on the bed, straining to tighten the cord, was a very pale, very pretty, bald woman wearing makeup in an outfit that would have made a trucker blush. I panicked and was stepping backward when the naked older woman's bulging eyes caught mine and she nodded wildly.
Let go! I yelled, moving deeper into the room, aiming right at the bald woman. Let go, or I will shoot you!
Chapter 72. The bald woman started, stepped back, let go of the rope, and stared at me and the gun before raising her trembling hands and saying hoarsely,
What is this?
I grabbed a robe off a chair, tossed it over to the older woman I assumed was Pauline Stryker, and came around behind her, still aiming at the bald woman. "Get down on your knees, Coco, then face down on the bed, hands behind your head," I said. She seemed even more frightened now that she realized I knew her name, and she started to lower herself to her knees while I worked the gag off Mrs. Stryker. She spit it out, choked, and cried, "Hee!
Are you the police?"
Coco asked from one knee. "The next best thing," I said, pulling out my cell phone. "Just need to know one thing, Mrs. Stryker. Was that consensual, or was your life in danger?" Before the older woman could speak, Coco said in a deep male voice that startled me,
"Of course it was consensual. Pauline, tell him. You can't have our interlude coming out in the Palm Beach Post, not with Edwin's new thing just around the corner. It would be everywhere."
I gaped for a second, realizing that Coco had to be Jeffrey Mize. But even though the person in front of me was bald, my brain was having trouble with the idea that she was a he. If not for the lack of hair, Mize could have been an aging supermodel. "Mrs. Stryker," I said, feeling unsure now, "please answer my question." The older woman seemed less upset than before, and she looked at me, then over at Mize, who was on all fours gazing at her.
"Tell him, Pauline, whoever he is."
Mrs. Stryker swiveled her head to look at me, choked out,
"Who are you?"
"A good Samaritan," I said. "I'm here to help and to contact the police if you need them."
"Wait,"
Mai said, pushing up into a kneeling position.
"You're not a cop?"
"How did you get in here?"
Mrs. Stryker asked, sounding angry. "That's not important. What's important is whether this was consensual or not," I said, feeling the situation slipping away from me.
"It was consensual," she said emphatically. "But I most certainly did not consent to having you in my house holding me and my guest at gunpoint. Who are you, and what are you after?"
"Who I am doesn't matter," I said, trying to figure out a way to exit gracefully and anonymously. "What matters is that Mr. Mize has been linked to the murders of 3 Palm Beach socialites."
"That's not true,"
Mize snapped. "He painted their portraits, Lisa Martin, Ruth Abrams, Maggie Crawford. Is there a portrait of you here in the house, Pauline? Were you about to become number 4? Mrs. Stryker looked bewildered for a moment and then said,
"I don't know anything about that."
"See?"
Mize said, smiling and straightening. It was time to either cut and run or do something audacious. I chose audacious.
"Then I apologize, and I'll be going," I said, lowering the gun.
"But I'd rather see you free of your bonds before I go."
"That's not necessary."
"I insist," I said. Taking my eyes off my eyes, I squeezed my phone, then crouched and set it on the carpet behind the ladder-back chair at the foot of the bed. With my left hand, I began working at the knots. My right thumb found the latch on the Ruger, and I pressed it before I moved the gun to my left hand. I made a sound of frustration, set the pistol on the bedspread, and set to work in earnest on the knots. I'd undone 2 and was stepping around Mrs. Stryker when Mize dove on his belly, grabbed the Ruger, and aimed it at me point blank.
"I don't know who you are, but I am going to enjoy killing you,"
Mize said in Coco's voice.
"And don't you move now, Pauline. We have unfinished business, you and I."
"No, Jeffrey, I..." Mize slammed the butt of the gun backward, hitting the side of Mrs. Stryker's head and opening up a rectangular cut that bled as she moaned.
"Why'd you do that?" I demanded.
"I needed her out of the way, so you and I could have fun,"
he said, coming off the bed, gun 3 feet from my chest.
"Who are you?"
My mind was on overdrive, spinning through the little pieces of what I knew about Mize and the murders and what I'd heard coming up the stairs. "Why kill me?" I asked. "I don't fit your pattern, the mommy complex. Did you even have a father?"
"Shut up."
"It's not difficult to understand you hating your mother and taking it out on these women," I said.
"Miranda, your mother, humiliated you right from the beginning, dressed you up like a girl until age, what?"
Mize glared at me, said nothing. "I figure it had to be one of the few things that got you attention from her," I said. "Women's fashion and style were what you had in common. Maybe fashion was the only way you could tear Miranda away from all those men."
"You don't know anything about her."
"I know she spent a lot of money. I figure you barely inherited enough to keep up the house she left you. Or maybe between your trust and the portrait commissions and your shop, you had enough money for a while. But recently the trust ran out, or the commission stopped, or your shop began floundering. And it all got to be too much for you, didn't it, Jeffrey?" Mai seemed to be staring right through me now. "So you went to the women who knew you, the women you'd painted before, the ones who reminded you of your mother, and you decided to let off a little steam."
"Shut up," I said.
Mai shouted, and he shook the gun at me. "And maybe you stole money, jewels, and clothes from your victims, even the score a little. All of them, except Francie Letourneau. You took care of your maid because she was stealing from you. Isn't that right? Or no, because she discovered your secret life as Coco, and..."
"Enough!"
Mai screamed. He took a step closer and aimed the pistol at my face from less than a foot away.
"Mother always said to get rid of pests fast."
Chapter 73. I looked down the barrel of the Ruger, saw Mize's slender feminine hand squeezing on the trigger.
"Freeze, Coco!" Detective Johnson yelled. "Drop the gun or I'll shoot!"
"Don't worry, Detective," I said. "It's not loaded." Mize's flawless porcelain skin tightened over his exquisite cheekbones, and disbelief gave way to rage. He pulled the trigger. Nothing happened. He tried again. Nothing. He pulled the gun back as if he meant to chop me with it. Before he could, I slapped him silly, dazed him, and knocked him to the ground. Johnson was putting cuffs on him when Sergeant Drummond appeared, gasping for breath. "Tough trip over the gate?" I asked.
"You have no idea," Drummond said, wheezing. "I'm getting too old for this shit."
"You heard everything?" I asked, going past Mrs. Stryker, who was still bleeding and looking confused. I crouched down to the carpet and picked up my cell phone and the magazine from the Ruger.
"Loud and clear," the sergeant said, waving his cell at me. "Enough probable cause in anyone's book."
"Well, this is entrapment. I want a lawyer. I'm being persecuted."
"For what?"
Johnson demanded as he hauled him to his feet.
"Cross-dressing. Getting into a little weird sex. Right, Pauline?"
Mrs. Stryker raised her bleeding head and glared at him.
"He'd been a friend since he'd painted my portrait, and he just tried to kill me. He put on my lingerie, said I was his mother tonight, and tried to kill me. And I'll testify to it in court. Edwin's new deal be damned."
"Can we call an ambulance for you?" I asked, smiling.
"Please," she said. "And could you get me some clothes? I don't want to be seen this way."
"Tell me what you need," I said as Johnson hauled Mize from the room. She asked for the clothes Mize had stripped her of and held them in the robe against her when she stood unsteadily and walked to the bathroom. Before she closed the door completely, she peered out at me.
"Who are you?"
she asked.
Drummond said, "That's Alex Cross, don't you know?"
She shook her head and shut the door.
"That was something," the sergeant said as he scratched at his slack chin. "We good?" I asked. "Oh, you and me, we're fine," Drummond said. "Me and my boss in the DA, that may be another story."
"I don't know," I said. "Maybe the way I came in here gets some of it excluded in court. But so what? You know who killed the four now. Just have to rebuild the case based on what you know and prove it outside of here. And I'll testify however I'm allowed." Drummond thought about that, nodded, said,
"I suppose the most important thing was saving Mrs. Stryker and getting a lunatic cross-dresser off the streets of Palm Beach. Or out of the bedrooms, anyway."
The sergeant seemed to chew on something, and then he said,
"This how a lot of your cases go?"
"Actually, every single one of them is different.
After you make your statement, you'll go back to North Carolina.
Tomorrow sometime, I hope."
"Get that guy Melvin Bell?"
"Marvin Bell. He's one of our suspects, but I haven't excluded anyone."
Sounds to me like he's your man.
Sirens wailed, coming closer. My gut says he is, too. But we'll see, I said.
Drummond stuck his hand out, said, A pleasure to meet you. And thank you for your help here.
I shook it, said, The feeling's mutual, Sergeant. I hope we see each other again someday.
He smiled that crooked smile of his, said, I'd like that.
The bathroom door opened. Mrs. Stryker came out in a beautiful nightgown and a new robe. She held a washcloth to her head.
Can you help me downstairs?
She asked, weakly.
I don't want to receive visitors in my bedroom.
Of course, I said, coming over and giving her my elbow. She held on to it. Drummond stepped aside. We walked slowly out into the hallway. At the far end, beyond the stairs, hung a portrait in oil. I had to hand it to Mize. As Coco, he had captured Pauline Stryker at what must have been the pinnacle of her beauty and charm.
Chapter 74. Starksville, North Carolina. In the remodeled kitchen of the house where I grew up, Nana Mama stared at me blankly and said quietly,
Your father lived another 2 years?
I nodded and gave her the rest of it, including the suicide, including a description of her son's small tombstone. My grandmother held a trembling fist to her mouth. With her other hand, she plucked off her glasses and wiped at tears.
Why'd he kill himself?
She asked. Guilt, grief, the aloneness, I said.
I don't think we'll ever know. He must have been the one.
What one?
The caller, Nana Mama said. For the first year or two that you lived with me, always around a holiday or, come to think of it, one of you boys' birthdays, I'd get a call with no one on the other end. At first, I thought it was just a mistake. But I'd hear things in the background, a television or music playing, and then the line would click dead.
When did that stop? I asked.
Around 2 years after you came to D.C.?
The timeline fit, but before I could say so, Janny rapped on the frame of the kitchen entrance.
We have to go. I want a chance to warm up on my own.
I checked my watch. We did have to go.
You all right? I asked Nana Mama as I stood up from the table.
She hesitated and then said,
I suppose I am. Better than before.
He was punished for his sins and then he died, I said. My grandmother said,
There's balance there. Should we go?
You're up to the ride?
Wouldn't miss it, she said.
And she got to her feet. She put her hand on my arm.
Thank you, Alex.
For what?
Clearing things up.
Wish it had turned out some other way for him.
I do too. I always will.
I helped Nana Mama out onto the porch, where Janny, Bree, Ali, and Pinky were waiting. We trooped out to the car in my cousin's truck. Ali and Janny wanted to ride with Pinky. To my surprise, so did my little grandmother, who looked cute and ridiculous in the front seat of the one-ton pickup.
I've never ridden in one of these, she called out the window, and she waved with such enthusiasm that Bree and I had to grin.
She's one of a kind, Bree said, climbing into the Explorer.
Could you imagine if there were two? I said, starting the car.
I don't think the world would be big enough, Bree chuckled, leaned over, and kissed me. Anyway, I'm glad you're back.
Me too. And by the way, I loved the welcome back celebration last night.
She laughed contentedly, said,
that was nice, wasn't it?
We held hands as we followed Pinky through town. Nearing the railroad tracks, Bree said,
Think we have time to stop?
Probably, but I don't know the way. Can we do it coming back?
Bree looked longingly at the tree line beyond the tracks.
It's funny how you want to check every couple of hours. It's like gambling.
I can see that, I said, and we drove on.
The road soon became steep and windy, and it dropped off the plateau in a series of lazy S-turns.
I noticed play in the Explorer's wheel that hadn't been there before, and the brakes were slightly sluggish.
Remind me to check the fluid levels in Raleigh, I said.
Didn't we do everything before our drive down here?
Bree asked.
Yes, but something doesn't feel quite.
There was a slight clanking noise, The car shuddered. "That can't be good," Bree said. "You better pull over and take a look." We were on a 10%, maybe 12% grade at that point, with low guardrails giving way to sheer banks of trees. Ahead, there was a scenic lookout. I put on my blinker, tapped the brakes. Nothing. I pumped the brakes. The car slowed only slightly, then gave another clank and shudder. Then, the vehicle seemed to break free of all restraint, and we went into an accelerating pell-mell runaway descent. Chapter 75. We hurtled down the road. Ahead of us, it veered sharply left, and all you could see beyond it was pale blue sky. "Alex!" Bree screamed as I clawed at the wheel and stomped vainly on the brake pedal. I grabbed the shifter, tried to slam it into low. The arm wouldn't budge. "Jesus, Alex, where?" With my left foot, I stabbed at the emergency brake pedal, but did not put it to the floor for fear we'd be thrown into a spin. There was a screeching noise as the tires caught, leaving smoke rising off the rubber-blackened road. The Explorer lurched to one side and then another, but I managed to keep it from going sideways, and then, just before that hard left turn, I slammed the shifter arm down and the engine braked us some more. I spun the wheel hard and got the front end around. The rear quarter panel of the car slammed into the guardrail, which tore off the bumper and flung it into the other lane and behind us. The rest of the ride down the plateau was marred only by the smell of burning brake pads, the roar of a straining engine, and the sweat pouring off both our foreheads. When we reached flatter land, I threw the shifter in neutral and turned the car off. We coasted to a stop on the shoulder, and I put on the hazard lights, laid my head back. "You should call Pinky," I said. "Tell him to make room in the truck." "Aren't you going to see what happened?" Bree asked. "I'm not a car guy," I said. "We're going to have it towed somewhere and looked at." "You're going to have to file an accident report," she said, digging out her phone and punching in Pinky's number. "I'd miss Janny," I said. "I'll leave a note with my name and number." "That's called leaving the scene of..." "I don't care," I said. "Just call him before he gets too far down the road." When they came back, we intentionally understated the situation, saying only that it seemed something was wrong with the brakes, but we were fine. I used my phone to find a towing company that agreed to get the car and to take it to a dealership in Winston-Salem. And then I sat back, put my arm around Bree, and closed my eyes. I fell into one of those strange, buzzing sleeps that follow stressful experiences. I didn't remember a minute of the hour and a half drive to Duke. We blundered around before we found the track. Even with a close call, we were early enough that Janny was able to start jogging before any of the other athletes arrived. They were all there by 11, however, along with Coach Green, who smiled as she came over to me. "Glad you made it," she said, shaking my and Bree's hands. "Janny was so excited she was up before dawn," I said. "No way we weren't making it," Bree said. The coach's grin disappeared. "Just to follow up, those blood and urine tests?" "Haven't heard yet," I said. "But again, innocent until..." "Of course," she said, and then she handed me another waiver and apologized for my having to fill another one out. "This will be interesting, though." "How's that?" Nana Mama asked. The coach gestured to three women doing ballistic jumps and skips along the track to warm up. "Alice and Tricia are here at Duke. Dawn's over at Chapel Hill, and all three were second-team All-Americans this past season." "Janny know that?" Bree asked. "I kind of hope not," Coach Green said, and she trotted off. "What's an All-American?" Ali asked. "They're among the best in the whole country," I said. "Is Janny?" "Course not," Nana Mama said. "Your sister's only 15, but it will be a good experience for her." As I'd seen her do twice before, Coach Green led the girls through a series of exercises designed to get their quick twitch muscles warmed up, loose, and firing. When they were ready, she broke them into squads of five and ran them through an Indian drill, where they ran at 40% unless they were at the rear of the pack. Then they had to sprint to the front. They did this twice at 400 meters. Janny seemed to have no problem coming from behind in those long, fluid strides and then taking her place at the lead. After a 5-minute break for water and more stretching, Green made some switches, bringing my daughter over with the All-Americans in their early 20s, and another girl who was at least 4 years older than Janie. They were watching my daughter out of the corners of their eyes. As I'd seen again and again since earlier that year, Janie seemed unfazed by the age and experience differences. "They gonna race now?" Ali asked, standing on the bleacher next to me. "It's just practice," Bree said. "Not for Janie," I said. "Let's take it to 75%, ladies," Green said when they were lined up shoulder to shoulder. 3, 2, 1, go! The older girls took off in short, choppy strides that soon opened into longer bounds and a less frenzied rhythm. Janie seemed to come up to speed effortlessly, but lagged a few feet behind the 19-year-old and was 2 yards behind the All-American trio entering the backstretch. Janie stayed right there until she'd rounded the near turn, picked up her pace slightly coming down the stretch, and finished just off the shoulder of the 19-year-old. She was 4 paces off the older girls, who were breathing hard. 2 of them looked at Janie and nodded. No smile from my daughter, just a nod back. The second quarter mile, at 85%, finished much the same way. Then Green called for 90% effort. Something about the way Janie rolled her shoulders back and down let me know that it had become serious now. And even though there were fewer than 15 people scattered across the bleachers watching, I couldn't help but stand. For the first time, Janie adopted that same chopping fast gait off the line and stayed right with the elite bunch as they rounded the first turn. The older girls picked up the pace down the backstretch. Janie stayed just off the shoulders of the All-Americans. The 19-year-old faded. My daughter made her move coming into the second turn. She accelerated right by the 3 and was leading as they entered the stretch. Even without binoculars, you could see the disbelief on the faces of the older girls, followed by the grit and determination that had gotten them close to the pinnacle of their sport. They poured it on, and 2 of them ran Janie down and passed her before the finish. But my girl was a stride behind them, and a stride ahead of one of the national class athletes coming across the line. Chapter 76.
"That was a race," Ali said.
"Janie made it a race," Pinky said, smiling. "Oh, my God, she's good." "Dr. Cross," a man said, coming across the grandstand toward us. Clad in unmarked gray sweats and a blue hoodie, he was in his 50s, a welterweight redhead with a rooster's confident manner.
"I'm Ted McDonald. To be honest, I came here to watch one of the other girls, but I'd very much like to talk to you about Janie."
"What about Janie?" Nana Mama asked, eyeing him suspiciously. McDonald glanced at the track, where Green and another older woman in warm-ups were talking to the girls.
"I'm a track coach and a scout of sorts. I'd like to share something with you and Janie, but let's do it after Coach Green and Coach Fall have had a chance to talk with you. Would that work out?
Before we leave Durham today, you mean?
I know a great place for lunch that will help Janie nutritionally recover from that workout," McDonald said. "My treat?"
I glanced at Bree and Nana Mama, shrugged, said,
"Sure, why not?"
"Great, I'll find you in the parking lot," he said.
He smiled and handed me a card that read, "Ted McDonald, Extreme Performance Systems, Austin, Toronto, Palo Alto." McDonald shook my hand, went back up into the bleachers, and put his hood up. I didn't know what to make of it, so I started to Google him and his company. Before I could get the names typed in on my phone, up came Coach Green and the older woman in sweats, Duke's head coach, Andrea Fall. After introductions and handshakes, Coach Fall said, "I was skeptical after the Invitational and more so after Coach Green's descriptions of Janie's running in the 200. But now, I'm a believer. How are her grades?"
"Outstanding," Nana Mama said. "She's a worker."
"That makes things a lot easier," Coach Fall said. "I'd like to formally offer your daughter a full-ride scholarship to Duke when she's ready to attend."
"What?"
I said, dumbfounded. "Janie can't officially answer my offer until February of her senior year, but I wanted it on the table as the first of what I assume will be many offers," Coach Fall said.
"She's that good?" Bree asked in wonder.
I can count on one hand in 30 years of coaching the number of athletes I've seen who have Janny's potential, she replied. Barring injury, the sky's the limit.
This is just mind-boggling, I said.
I imagine so, Coach Fall said. So anytime you or Janny are confused or want to talk about her training or how things are going, feel free to call me. Whatever she chooses to do and whatever college she chooses in the long run is beside the point. Okay?
Okay, I said, and I shook her hand.
Take care of her, Coach Fall said. She's a thoroughbred. What kind of bred is Thoreau? Ali asked afterward.
A thoroughbred is a racehorse, Nana Mama said.
Janny's a horse?
She runs like one, Bree said, and she squeezed my hand. I squeezed back, full of pride, but also anxiety. I felt like I was way in over my head when it came to making decisions about Janny's future.
You going to tell Janny, Nana Mama asked, about the offer?
I have to, I said. But I'll wait for somewhere quieter. When Janny came up into the stand smiling, Ali said,
You got an offer?
What? I'll tell you later, I said, and hugged her. We're very proud of you. She beamed, said, Who knew?
God did, Nana Mama said. You've got something only God can give.
We walked out into the parking lot and found Ted McDonald waiting. He shook Janny's hand, told her what he told me, and led us to a nearby cafe that offered organic sandwiches and the like. We ordered, and he asked who would be making decisions about Janny's future training. I said I hadn't even begun to think about that process. McDonald said, Then I'm very glad I happened to be here. He filled us in on his impressive background, including his PhD in exercise physiology from McGill University, and his stints as a top coach with the Canadian and French National Track Federations. McDonald currently served as an independent training consultant to athletes at a number of U.S. universities, including Rice, Texas, Texas A&M, UCLA, USC, and Georgetown. He said, I'm also a scout for... Our lunch arrived. McDonald had ordered a salad for Janny, vegetables, broiled chicken, and hard-boiled eggs, and a smoothie made from Brazilian acai berries that she said was delicious. I tried a sip and ordered my own. While we ate, McDonald peppered Janny with questions. How many pull-ups could she do without stopping? How many push-ups? What was her best standing broad jump? Her vertical leap? Flexibility? Endurance? Her mile time? Fastest recorded quarter? Janny didn't know the exact answer to some questions, but others she knew right off the top of her head. The questions went on. Had she ever long jumped, high jumped, pole vaulted, hurdled? Janny shook her head. No matter, he said. Tell me what happens when you run. I mean, what's the experience like for you? Janny thought about that, said. I sort of go off in my own world and everything gets kind of slow. Nerves before your race?
Not really, no.
Not even today?
No. Why?
The girls you finished with in that last run were all Americans.
Really?
Janny said, surprised.
Really?
She grinned.
I think I could have beat them.
I bet you could have, he said. Then he grabbed a napkin, pulled out a pen, and scribbled for a minute or two. He pushed the napkin across the table to me and Janny. It read, WHPT. 2018, USNC. 2020, OGT5. 2021, WCPOD. 2022, WC. 2024, OGGM.
What's it mean? I asked.
He told me, and it felt like everything in our lives changed.
Chapter 77. Later that afternoon, I was still struggling with what Ted McDonald had written on the napkin at lunch. Was that possible? Should you even begin with that end in mind? He said we didn't have to give him an answer right away, Bree said from the driver's seat of a rental car we'd picked up in Winston-Salem. I know, I said, but it's just a lot to take in.
You don't think she should try?
She's only 15, I said. Is this when they start thinking like that?
Other kids in other sports sure do, she said as we drove past the Welcome to Starksville sign.
I stared again at the napkin and wrestled with its meaning. Women's Heptathlon, 2018 U.S. National Champion. 2020, Olympic Games Top 5. 2021, World Championships Podium. 2022, World Champion. 2024, Olympic Games Gold Medalist. Was any of this possible? McDonald said it was. He said Janny might win any of the titles he'd listed as a pure runner, but he'd seen such athleticism in my daughter that he thought she'd be better suited to the grueling multi-skill heptathlon event. The heptathlon decides the best female athlete in the world, McDonald said. You interested in being that athlete, Janny? The one who can do anything? Superwoman? You could see it in my daughter's face, how in the very instant he'd thrown out that spark, Janny had caught fire. What would it take? She asked. Your heart, your soul, and years of hard work, he said. You up to that? She glanced at me and then back at him and nodded. I got chills. McDonald said that if Janny consented, he'd visit her regularly in Washington, D.C. during the year to teach her the various events within the heptathlon. She'd compete as a runner until he was satisfied with her skills. If we were all happy after the first year, he'd arrange a scholarship at a private school in Austin, where she could work with him on a more consistent basis. The school's excellent. They'll challenge her academically so she's ready for wherever she decides to go to college, he said. Bree said, How much is this going to cost us? Zero, the coach said. What? I said. How's that possible? McDonald said he was funded by several athletic shoe and apparel companies and charged with finding and nurturing track talent. If Janny became the kind of athlete he thought she was, she'd be in line for endorsements that would make her life easier in the long run. Free education, a career as a professional athlete, Olympic. They're heading home, Alex, Bree said, breaking into my thoughts. Nana Mama, Ali, and Janny were in Pinky's pickup in front of us. Pinky reached his massive forefinger hand out of the window, crossing the railroad tracks, and waved to us. I waved back as Bree put on the blinker and pulled into the old Piggly Wiggly parking lot. I folded the napkin, put it in my shirt pocket. Think she can do it? Bree asked as we headed toward the line of trees on that short bluff above the tracks. I'm beginning to think she's like you, I said, capable of anything and everything. She smiled, poked me in the rib, said, When'd you get so sweet? Day I met you. Good answer. I have my moments. When we reached the trees, Bree led me to a big beech tree that overlooked the tracks. There were steel steps screwed into the tree. She said bow hunters used them, and she'd bought them at the local Army Navy. She climbed up around 10 feet to another recent purchase. The Bushnell Night Vision Trail Camera was designed to take pictures of whatever came by. Hunters used them to pattern deer. There seemed to be a commercial for them every 8 minutes on the Outdoor Channel. Even Jim Shockey uses them, Bree said. So I thought, why not? We'll take pictures of every train that comes through Starksville. Bree had put up this camera and another one 300 yards west. She checked the memory cards once after 24 hours and found pictures of riders heading north on the train late Thursday afternoon, just about the time we'd seen riders the previous Thursday as we drove into town. Now she traded memory cards on both cameras and reactivated them. We took the cards back to the rental car and looked at them on her computer. It took us a while to scroll through them, but we saw pictures of more riders taken the night before at 10, roughly the same time Bree saw Finn Davis giving that three-finger salute on Wednesday night. Davis was not in any of the new photographs, but Bree's patterns had been established. Riders at 10 o'clock every other night. Riders at 5 on alternate afternoons. It was 4:30 by then. Someone should ride by within the hour. Despite the heat, we decided to return to the trees to see if the pattern would hold. As we sweated and waited, bugs whined all around us, and I had the creepy feeling there were ticks crawling up my legs. My phone rang. Naomi. Stefan's been beaten again, she said. Some jail inmates got to him. I sighed, said, It's like that in every prison with child killers and abusers. Except Stefan didn't do it, Uncle Alex, Naomi said forcefully. Right. Where is he?
In Starksville Memorial under guard, she said. The train signal at the crossing to our right 100 yards ahead started to ring. I'll try to stop by to... I began before noticing a train coming slowly out of the south. 20 cars back, I could make out a lone rider. Got to go, Naomi. Just one rider, Bree said as I pocketed the phone. Better than none, I said. How do you want to handle this? She asked as the train engine groaned by at less than 15 miles an hour. Get the car and parallel me heading north, I said. I'll call you. Where are you going? On that train, I said as the lone rider, a young white guy wearing a baseball cap, sunglasses, and a long black t-shirt went past. He was sitting with his legs off the front of the freight car, looking straight ahead. When I turned, Bree was already gone. I waited until another 15 cars had gone by before I left the trees, jumped off the bluff, and started to sprint. Chapter 78. Cutting at an angle to the train, I timed it so a steel ladder welded into one of the boxcars was coming right by me before I sped up one last time, stabbed out my hand, and caught one of the rungs at head height. Before it could jerk me off my feet, I jumped and got my shoes on the lowest rung. I hung there for 6 or 7 breaths. Then the dinging of the train crossing bell reminded me I was about to be seen by all the cars waiting on my side of the tracks. I clambered up. Car horns honked as my boxcar passed through the crossing. I didn't look over my shoulder and didn't go up on top until we were well beyond it and the train was starting to pick up speed. I peeked over the edge of the container car to check on the rider, make sure he was still looking forward, before I crawled up onto the roof. I laid flat, holding onto one of the flanges until I had enough breath and strength to get up. James Bond makes it look easy, but standing on top of a slow-moving train is tough. Stalking forward on a jolting, swaying, accelerating train takes superhuman balance that I do not possess. I couldn't stand up straight at all and settled for a wide-footed crouch, taking one tentative step after another. Jumping to the next car made me nauseated, but I did it and kept on, staring at the rooftop right in front of me, then the rider, then the track far beyond, with the irrational fear that I was going to miss an oncoming tunnel and be swatted off the train. It took a solid 15 minutes to go 18 cars forward. I was trying to be ninja-like when I jumped to the 19th car, the one right behind the container car, upon which the rider was perched. I must have made some kind of sound, or maybe it was just time for him to look around. When I landed, he was staring right at me. He swung his right arm from his chest, revealing a pistol equipped with a sound suppressor. I threw myself flat just before he shot. The round pinged off the steel rooftop about 2 feet to my right. The rocking of the train had thrown off his aim, or he was a lousy shot, or maybe a combination of the two. In any case, I dug down, came up with my little Ruger 9mm just before he pulled the trigger again. His bullet clanged off a flange 6 inches from my head. I shot at him and missed, but it was enough to change the dynamics of things. He wasn't holding ground anymore. He was getting out of Dodge, jumping to the next car as I struggled to my feet. He was leaping to an oval-shaped tanker car when I jumped onto the container car behind him. I landed fine, but I didn't see the rider anymore. Then I realized he'd slipped when he'd landed on the tanker and done a face plant. He was slow to move, dazed by the hit, and I was able to close much of the gap between us. When he finally regained his feet, I saw he was no longer carrying the suppressed pistol. Had he dropped it? "Stop!" I yelled. "I just want to talk to you." But he kept moving forward. "Stop or I'll shoot." He didn't slow. I aimed to his left, sent a bullet by his ear. That caused him to cringe and turn toward me with his hands up. That's better, I thought. Now we're getting somewhere. Ahead, I could see we were approaching a train trestle. I cautiously jumped to the tanker and got another 10 feet closer to the rider. We were less than 20 feet apart. He crouched, holding onto a wheel on top of the tanker. "I just want to talk," I said again. "About what, man?" he asked, trying to act tough but looking scared. I held up my hand, showed him the three-finger salute, said, "I want to talk about this, and Finn Davis, and Marvin Bell, and you riding this train." He looked at me,
like I'd grown horns, and shook his head. No way, man! We know you're protecting something on this train. What is it? He looked away from me, shook his head again. No way! Can't! We can protect you! No, you can't, he said. Ain't no one can protect anyone from Grandfather and the company! Grandfather and the company? I said as the train started across the trestle, high above a deep, narrow canyon, thick with woods. Who's Grandfather? What's the company? Looking at me with a stricken expression, he said, Death of me! He let go of the wheel, launched out of the crouch, and dove off the tanker, off the trestle, screaming and waving his arms and trying to fly as he took the long fall to the treetops, crashed down through them, and vanished. Chapter 79. I couldn't believe it, and I twisted around, looking back and down into the canyon and the forest that had swallowed that young man whole. The only creatures I could see were crows, circling lazily above the canopy, all of which disappeared from my view when the train rounded a curve. The tunnel on the other side appeared so fast, I had to throw myself down on top of the tanker and hold tight until we exited the other side into deep woods. I tried to call Bree, but got no signal. There was no chance for me to get off the train for 10 miles. By the time it slowed and then stopped, night had fallen and the moon had risen. I'd come a long ways down in elevation. In the dim light, I could see agricultural fields to either side of the tracks. I peered ahead, looking for a road crossing. Why were we stopped? I was about to climb off when, Let's do this, man, a male voice called from down the embankment. I startled and then realized he was talking to me. What are we doing? I asked. Shit, man, don't be fucking around, he said, nervous, and I made out the silhouette of him below me. Give me the order. I got the cash. Sorry, I'm new, I said, improvising. How big's that order again? It's on your sheet, man, he said, irritated. Just open the hatch, get it, and we do business. I looked around. The wheel the rider had held on to, it controlled a hatch. I walked to it, knelt, and got hold of the wheel. Turning counterclockwise didn't work. Neither did turning it clockwise. Then I considered that the hatch might be under spring tension. I put my weight on it, felt something depress, and twisted. The wheel turned clockwise. When I heard a noise like unbuckling, I lifted. Up came the hatch lid, and the air was filled with a pleasant vanilla scent. I cupped the mini mag light I always carry, turned it on. Suspended beneath the hatch was an aluminum basket of sorts, about 3 feet deep and 2 feet in diameter. The flashlight beam shone through large holes in the walls of the basket, revealing dozens of yellow paper packages, each about the size of a large bar of soap. Some were banded together, others were single.
Come on, man, the guy said. Train's gonna leave for...
The train wheel squealed. The tanker lurched. I almost fell. I almost let go of the hatch lid, the basket, and whatever was in it.
Hey, he yelled. Hey, shit, man!
Couldn't be helped, I called down.
Something wrong with the mechanism. I'll put your order in for 10:20 delivery tomorrow night. You'll get a discount.
A pause.
How much?
10%, I yelled as we pulled away.
Deal, man! That'll work!
I waited until he was far behind me, then sat with my legs spread against the walls of the hatch. I moved around the basket, inspecting it with the flashlight, and found a hinged door. I opened it, removed 3 of those yellow paper packages. Each of them weighed about a pound. My phone rang then. It was Bree.
Where are you?
She asked anxiously.
I've been calling you.
We went off the plateau and there were tunnels and I have no idea where I am.
You talked to the rider?
I told her all that had happened.
Jesus, he jumped?
I couldn't believe it, like it was better to die than talk to me and face this grandfather's wrath.
You think Marvin Bell is grandfather?
It seems likely. So drugs in the yellow packages? I'm assuming so, I said. Ingenious if you think about it, using the trains.
It is. You gonna stay on the train and see where it takes you?
No, I'm putting the basket back, sealing the hatch, and then getting off at the next stop. We'll let Belle or whoever is behind this think their man bailed with some of their product.
Makes sense, she said.
I'll call back soon, give you my location. Well down the track, I could see streetlights. I'd replaced the basket and hatch cover by the time the train stopped for the second time. On my right, from the brush by the track, I heard a sharp whistle. Instead of answering it, I crept down a ladder on the opposite side of the tanker and slipped away as the whistle became louder and more insistent.
Chapter 80. The sweet little girl with sleepy eyes carried a piece of sheepskin about the size and shape of a face towel. Lizzie rubbed it against her porcelain cheek and sucked her thumb as she ambled across the room to her grandfather. He had terrible things twisting and knotting in his mind, but seeing her so precious, so innocent, they all unraveled. He scooped Lizzie up, said, "Time for bed, young lady?" She nodded, snuggled into his arms, made him feel perfect. She was hardly a weight at all, not a burden, never a burden. Lizzie's grandfather carried her from his office down the hall to her bedroom. He got her safe and warm under her sheets and blanket. Her eyes fluttered toward sleep, but she said,
"Tell me the story. What happens next to the fairy princess? To Guinevere?"
Her grandfather hesitated and then said, "One day, a dragon came into Princess Guinevere's kingdom." Lizzie became more alert.
"Did the dragon hurt Guinevere?"
"He tried. But Guinevere's grandfather, the fairy king, sent out his best warriors to slay the dragon. Guinevere's older brother tried first, but failed to kill the beast that threatened the fairy kingdom. A girl warrior went next." Lizzie was listening raptly now. She said,
"Did she have a bow and arrow?"
He nodded, said, "She shot at the dragon as he flew by, and missed him by an inch." A soft knock came behind him. Meeks stood there, dead serious. "Someone downstairs needs to see you," Meeks said. He understood, nodded. "I'll be a minute yet."
"No, grandfather," Lizzie complained. "What about the dragon?"
"I'll tell you tomorrow night," he said.
"Oh,"
she moaned.
"I can't wait. Does she get another shot at the dragon? The girl warrior? What's her name?"
He thought, said, "Lace. And yes, Lace gets another shot at the dragon. But I won't tell you what happens until tomorrow." Lizzie yawned, said,
"Lacey will get the dragon. She'll save Princess Guinevere. I just know it."
As her eyes started to flutter shut, he leaned over and kissed her cheek. He turned the light off, but left the door to the hallway open a crack, just the way she liked it. He walked down the hall, thinking how many changes were underway, and how many challenges they created. Downstairs, he walked past oil paintings and sculptures into a library. Finn Davis was standing there, looking unsure and uncomfortable. "What is it?" Lizzie's grandfather asked. "We lost a company man," Davis said. "His deliveries were never made."
"Product?"
"All but 3 pounds intact."
"Runner, then.
You want him tracked down?" Davis asked.
"Dealt with?"
"Of course, but we have more pressing problems."
"The crosses?"
Lizzie's grandfather nodded, said,
"They survived the lace maker. She'll try again. Meantime, I think you should take another stab at the big bad dragon."
Chapter 81. At 8:30 on Monday morning, Pinky drove me and Bree to the courthouse, where Stefan's trial was about to resume. Nana Mama was coming later with Aunt Hattie and Aunt Connie. Janny was taking care of Ali. I felt raw and irritated. Bree and my cousin looked wrung out. We'd been at this for the past 36 hours, with very little sleep, and the secrets of Starksville were as murky and shape-shifting as they'd ever been. We'd cut open one of the yellow paper packages,
and found heavy-gauge plastic vacuum-sealed around what looked like loose blocks of shattered topaz-colored glass. The taste and smell had been unremarkable, so I'd called in a few favors from friends at the FBI crime lab at Quantico. They'd be receiving the samples and analyzing them later in the afternoon. We still had no idea who owned the tanker. The trail camera had taken a good picture of that tanker's right side, revealing a code of 15 letters and numbers stenciled in black. When we reviewed all the earlier pictures of riders, the majority were sitting one freight car back from similar tankers with similar codes. Pinky had worked at the codes, trying to track them all Sunday afternoon and evening, but had gotten nowhere. Bree and I had taken up position in those trees above the tracks in Starksville around 9 the night before and stayed long past 11. No riders passed us. In short, we'd had no luck linking Marvin Bell or Finn Davis or anyone else to the so-called grandfather and the company. We had even begun to speculate that the rioters and the drug ring had nothing to do with Starksville, that the operation was organized elsewhere and the shipments just passed through. I'm wondering if that rioter disappearing triggered some kind of shutdown in the delivery system, Pinky said, taking a left into the town square. Could be, I agreed. I think there's a way to see if the rioters are from Starksville, Bree said. Okay, I said. More trail cameras, she said. We set them at crossings to the north and south. If the rioters are from elsewhere, they'll already be aboard. Pinky nodded as he pulled into the courthouse parking lot. And if they're not, we know this is their origination point. And no one around here manufactures vanilla, right? I asked. Not that I know of, Pinky said, parking. When we reached the courthouse lobby, reporters, spectators, and witnesses streaming toward the trial venue were abuzz with news of Sheriff Nathan Bean's fatal heart attack at a local breakfast cafe not an hour before. Sheriff Bean had had a history of heart problems, but it seemed a shock nonetheless. In the courtroom, I heard a reporter ask Starksville Police Chief Randy Sherman who the likely replacement was. Sheriff's voted in, Chief Sherman replied. But I'd bet Guy Petalini would be a strong candidate. I flashed on Bree's description of Finn Davis standing on Petalini's back porch a few nights before, and for the first time, I felt as if there might really be a puppet master pulling the strings behind the scenes in Starksville. Grandfather? Even without concrete evidence against him, I could plainly see Marvin Bell in that role, hanging back in the shadows, looking legitimate, and using Finn Davis to do his bidding. We figured Bell and Davis were bribing Petalini. How else did a detective afford a nice house on a lake like that? A side door opened. A deputy led Stefan into the courtroom. I winced and heard my Aunt Hattie cry out. My cousin's left eye was bruised closed, and his jaw was wired shut. Naomi rushed forward, looking furious as she helped him to his seat. Serves him right, I heard a woman whisper, and I looked across the aisle at Ann Lawrence, who was talking to a sober Cece Turnbull. Rashawn's mother didn't reply, but Cece's parents, who were sitting two rows behind, bobbed their heads in agreement. District Attorney Delilah Strong, however, seemed genuinely concerned about my cousin's condition. So did her assistant, Matthew Brady, who walked over to say something to Naomi. She waved him off angrily. Patty Converse came in and sat in the row behind us. It was the first time we'd seen her in 5 days. She didn't look at any of us, just stared blankly as the clerk and the court reporter took their positions. The bailiff called out, "All rise. This court is now in session. Judge Erasmus P. Varney presiding." Chapter 82. Judge Varney was weaker and sallower than the last time I'd seen him, when he'd been flushed and contorting against the pain of kidney stones as EMTs rolled him from the courtroom.